Hello, hello. Welcome back to the Seed in Society podcast. I am super excited for our guest today, Leah Brown. She is a FRSA problem solver whose distinguished legal career and commitment to fostering genuine accountability are deeply rooted in her personal experiences.
Curious about owning land, growing your own food, or building income that doesn't depend on you showing up every day? That's what I'm doing. And this is where I share exactly how. Welcome to Seed in Society. I'm Makeda Boehm, an AI strategist, homesteader, and tech sales leader turning paychecks into lasting multi-million dollar wealth. I use automation, food producing land, and digital income streams to build real assets and long-term freedom for my family and help others do the same. If you're done trading time for survival and want to build on your own terms, you're in the right place.
So, Leah is an accredited mediator dedicated to promoting authentic accountability and rebuilding trust. And I'm really excited to have this conversation because her focus is on restorative approaches that really empower individuals and drive systemic change, ensuring that institutions confront uncomfortable truths and move beyond superficial compliance. Thank you for joining. Introduce yourself to the audience.
Oh, well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me. Yeah. I am Leah, and I rebuild trust when things get political or when egos get out of hand. I hold space for difficult conversations, and I'm really passionate about helping people reach those light bulb moments where they see themselves more clearly, but also figure out what they want to do to move forwards.
Okay, that is super interesting. Tell me how you got into that.
So,
I'm going to rebuild trust.
Yeah, I am a corporate mergers and acquisitions lawyer by training. And that means that I spend a lot of time with executive committees and boards of directors. I've sat on several boards as well. And let's just say board members might be of one mind when it comes to the mission of the organization, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are sharing the same values or have the same priorities in life. And so relationships can be strained, particularly when it's not clear how to attribute responsibility when things go wrong. And so I've spent a lot of time working with boards in really, really difficult crisis-related situations or succession-related situations to help them figure out how to get beyond the crisis, how to solve the problem, and then how they want to move forwards. And part of that has seen a lot of relationships go awry. So the rebuilding trust element has come from that.
Okay, no, that is definitely something I can understand. By trade, I'm an account executive, so always hearing about what the board is, and I'm on the revenue side. But I also just recently did a board leadership program with the University of Pennsylvania in conjunction with Diverse Force. And it was really interesting for 6 months, just all that it takes to actually be a present and responsible member of a board. So I'm interested to kind of hear how you balance that with making sure it goes beyond compliance, that people are genuinely trying to find a solution.
Yeah, I think the distinction between the board's role to help set the strategy of the organization and to hold the executive to account is distinct from the operational day-to-day. And so a lot of board management is keeping people on track with what is the board's responsibility and what isn't the board's responsibility, and what are the legal obligations of the individuals around the table versus where is that responsibility shared elsewhere. And when it comes to finances and taxes particularly, you know, that can be an area where it feels like that compliance is delegated to an individual, even though the whole board shares that responsibility. I think for me, in terms of solving problems, values-driven problem solving is very important to me. And I think holding up a mirror to what the individuals say the values that are driving their decisions are, but also what is the organization subscribing to in terms of what it's publicly saying its values are, and using that lens to kind of make determinations as to, well, is this in keeping with our values if we make the decision this way, or what is more important? And so I often say, okay, you've asked for 5 things. You can have 1, 2, 4, and 6, or you can have 1, 2, 3, or you can have 4, 5, and 6. Which are most important to you? And we kind of work that through in a way that enables people to really feel what's most important to them. And sometimes that's reputation, sometimes that's cost saving, sometimes that is what's in the best interest of the people around the table. It just depends on each individual organization.
Okay. No, that is super fascinating. It's one of those things where, so Seed in Society is really about sovereignty, but also about like leadership and learning how to be in, like, make conflict resolution. That's going to pop up in honestly just any aspect of life. This is a life skill. And you need to know how to do it, just like you need to know how to manage money and brush your teeth. So what is kind of your advice for, like, making sure that people are approaching things in a way that honors that truth of, like, compromise and, yeah, just like compromise?
Yes. Well, when I'm lecturing, I have to teach the conflict resolution syllabus, and there's different types of conflict that each individual comes to the table with depending on their family of origin. So you might be prone to be a very collaborative problem solver, but you might also be prone to be a very adversarial conflict resolver, i.e. it's my way or the highway. And so I think understanding people's different conflict types is very helpful. But I think to answer your question, taking a step back, most people do not communicate nearly half as clearly as they think that they do. So I might be saying X, Y, Z to you, and you might be hearing A, B, C. But I think that I've clearly said, no, it's X, Y, Z. And I think sometimes we are in such a rush to communicate a message and not necessarily that engaged in ensuring somebody else has understood what it is that we're saying. So slowing down those kind of conversations and helping people to be more reflective, to say, so what I've understood from what you've just said is this, or please correct me if I've misunderstood this, but this is what I've heard. And injecting that clarification in the narrative has revealed so many more misunderstandings that people have been carrying around with them for a long time, or misinterpretations of what other people think about them, or a misunderstanding of something that has been escalated to the board and why it's been escalated and who was responsible for that decision. And because of the way that we communicate in modern society, you might have a Slack message, you might have an email, you might have a text, you might have a telephone call, you might have an in-person meeting, you might have an impromptu team huddle, and you're looking for, where did I get this information from? And things get lost in translation. So I think the assumption is, let's assume we're not communicating very clearly when it comes to how the conflict has arisen. And if we want to get to the root of that, be patient enough to sit with it long enough to figure out, how has this arisen and what is my part in it, before I go blaming somebody else for why we're still in it.
That is, whoever's listening to this, make sure that you replay that part, because accountability is huge. And same thing with communication. So I know that you are a US and a UK national. So already just the very basics of the difference between UK English versus US English. And I say this all the time, where it's like, just because I've said this word, it doesn't mean we have the same understanding of what the definition of any word is. We use it, but it's a very imprecise thing that, of course, you can work to try to get better at. But I can think, even when I'm talking with my husband, I can think I'm saying something so very clearly. I'm very direct, but I understand different communication styles, because some people, I don't know if you're like familiar with DISC at all. Like, I'm in enterprise sales. So I'm like a high I and a D. And then some people are SC, and you have to give them more facts before you go into it. And some people want it right away. Like, tell me what you're thinking. Don't like ask me how my day is or what's the weather. That drives them crazy. And trying to bring together all of those types of personalities can be challenging, but it's such an important skill to just learn how to make sure you do anything successfully is being able to communicate. And I think it's so important that you said it's something I have to do in work every time. If I'm selling, you know, I sell to like state institutions or government entities, public sector. So I'm talking to someone in the governor's office and I can't be like, this is what you want. It's what I heard you say is, and paraphrasing it to get some of that clarity out. What I'm interested in then from that perspective is how do you communicate without making a conflict worse?
So my job as a mediator is to leave my ego on the other side of the door. And that gives me a couple of opportunities sitting in the middle of conflict to be curious. So, you know, I can use my unfamiliarity with that individual or with their career to ask probing questions. I can get somebody to put themselves in the shoes of the other person to try and elicit some empathy. I can get somebody to be reflective about what they think is going on for the other person, but I can also really get them to drill down into what they're feeling. Now, if anybody on this podcast is familiar with British culture, trying to get somebody to articulate how they feel is nigh impossible. But actually, you can use other tools like, you know, when you go home today, what are you going to say to your wife about how this process went? Or what difference would it make to you if in 3 years' time, you weren't still dealing with this? Or how much of your time in your working week are you spending dealing with this conflict? And how much did you envisage this would be part of your job day to day? How long has this been going on for you? So that kind of curiosity surrounding the topic. But to not make conflict worse, you have to do a couple of things. You have to separate the person from the problem. I think so often we get so fixated on the problem. We're like, well, if they just do this or if they just do that, then this will all go away. It's like, well, hang on. What if there's a different solution? What if they never changed their posture? What are you able to do? And I think also helping people to see, I said this a couple of minutes ago, but see what they are contributing to the situation. What beliefs do they have about the other person or about the situation? Sometimes I sit down with somebody and I say, why hasn't this been able to be resolved earlier? You know, you're really good at your job. You know, you are absolutely the right person to be in this position in this company. They value you. You know, you're revered as a market leader. Why do you think that you've not been able to solve this? And so often they'll say, well, I have the answer, but it's just never going to work. And I'm like, well, what's preventing you from trying again? Because what do you need to know? If you know that you've got the answer, what is preventing you from acting on that so that you can resolve this? And sometimes it's fear. Sometimes it's irrational. Sometimes there are huge opportunity costs. Sometimes people are worried that they'll lose their job. Sometimes they're worried about the repercussions for the other person, whether that's telling the truth or ejecting them from the organization. And so I find that sometimes my role as a mediator in helping people get beyond conflict is empowering them to take that step that they've been putting off and unlocking those lies that they believed about themselves or the lies that they believed about the situation that prevent them from stepping up and doing what needs to be done.
This is such a great conversation already, Leah, because this, like, literally what you just said can be applied to people's relationships and not just like your romantic relationships. That's important for friendships, for parenting relationships. It's important for founders, people who run businesses. It's important for employees. Like, this is just a basic life skill. And I want to point that out again because you said curiosity. Being willing to ask questions, and this is something too that I am learning in my life, right? Like, I've gotten to the point where if I feel like I'm the smartest person in a room, which I never do, because I realize every single person you meet can teach you 10 things you don't know you don't know. But then I'm really in the wrong room, if it's like about gossip or something. But I've also learned that We all have our blinders. We all have our biases where we feel like this is the thing we know and this is the thing we've figured out, and no one can tell me anything new about it. And I'm sure you've heard this term a lot of times. I go, people just love to live in cognitive dissonance. It, like you said, if they changed XYZ, then I would change. And a big thing I've learned just in life, and you can tell me if this is something you've picked up too, is that it usually is with you. The only thing you can control is what you do. The only thing you can control truly is what you say, and you cannot keep giving your power away to other people and allow them to get you out of your zone. And of course, that's with nuance because this is work. And a lot of times when it's work, that's tied to your income, which is tied to how you survive. And that is where kind of your position is super important to make sure that that is able to be handled.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But I think I just want to say, as a word of encouragement, I am a founder. And I do struggle with this. And, you know, even last week, I was speaking to a good friend who is a graduate of Harvard Business School. And she said, oh, but Leah, you know, why do you think that this person is responding to you like that? And I, you know, gave an answer. She's like, interesting. But have you asked them for feedback? Have you asked them what one thing could you do differently, or what could improve their experience of whatever it is that you're asking them to do? And I was floored. I was embarrassed. I was floored. And I was like, you know, it is so difficult to exercise the skills that you deploy in your work life on yourself. But the obligation is, I'm living this too. And I recognize how challenging it is to be disciplined about exposing yourself to vulnerability. That's really what it is. You know, you're putting yourself out there and you're asking somebody to comment on something which is potentially going to tear you down or open you up to rejection. But that's how we grow. And that's how we move through difficult situations. And so if you want to be an ostrich and you want to bury your head under the sand, ditch the curiosity. If you want to stay in your conflicts, don't try to listen to the other person, and don't listen to yourself and continue overriding your feelings and your discomfort. But if you want to be free, step into a growth mindset. And that involves doing some of these things. And it is really liberating.
Absolutely. So I'm going into my keynote speaking era. I'm pitching and I'm starting my whole speaking business. And my message is around action is what builds confidence. So like you said, with that fear or the opportunity cost, the thing I say that I learned the most from my MBA was sunk cost theory. And I have a whole episode on it, because it's this idea that I went down this road so far and I know it's not working, but instead of being like, hey, I need to pivot, you keep doing it and it's a sunk cost. You're losing out more time, more money, more energy. And that's like a really big thing for me to just kind of see in my entire life. I have been what I like to call almost like a master pivoter. Like, I started with teaching and then I was in scientific sales. Now I'm in tech sales. Then I'm doing speaking and I'm a founder as well. And it's really about, in sales, something that you'd say is you like to get to the fast no. It's better when someone tells you quickly that they're not interested, because now you don't waste your energy and time. And it's the same thing in life. Like, doing the thing is always better than theorizing about doing the thing, because then either you jump into it and doing is what builds the confidence, or you do it, you realize, hey, I freaking hate this thing. And now you didn't waste, you know, 5 years and 8 degrees on figuring out I don't even like to actually do the thing. And this is straight life advice, because anything you do, whether it's a homestead, whether it's a business, whether it's your job, like, you need to stay curious, do the thing, and what you said very clearly, keep a growth mindset.
Yeah, I think these things don't come very naturally to a lot of people. And I think we are trained to fear conflict. And, you know, as humans, we are very good at avoidance of anything that makes us feel uncomfortable, incompetent, I suppose negative in any way. But I don't think that conflict has to be something that people are afraid of. And I think really great things can come out of conflict. You know, if you see it as a relationship deepening exercise, rather than presuming it's inevitable that the relationship will collapse because you've experienced a kind of conflict, you know, people should be encouraged to, it's a kind of classic celebrate your differences. We're not all supposed to be carbon copies of one another. And if we all think the same thing, the world would be really boring. So I think, yes, again, whether that's family at Thanksgiving, having different political views, or whether that's, you know, not respecting the opinion of a colleague because it's just so much of a departure from your family of origin, you know, you've got to create effective ways to communicate so that we can both agree to disagree, but remain in relationship. And I think that's something that we've struggled with in recent years. And part of that is because people don't see it as a communication issue. They see it as a right and wrong.
You are 1,000,000% correct. Like, these conversations, and I say this every time, I'm so excited when I have guests on and that it's just authentic with what kind of energy I was trying to put out there to have these kind of conversations, because I am a Philly girl who lives in a rural Tennessee town with no stoplights. Talk about culture change. But I've also, you know, I've traveled to over 10 countries. I did middle school in Ghana. So being able to see different people, and my undergrad is in sociology. So let's talk about it in African American studies. But pluralism, what you just said, literally the ethos, I wrote it in like our mission of Seed in Society, is pluralism. You do not ask other flowers in a garden to look like the other flower. The garden is beautiful, not despite the differences, but because of it. And I feel like, especially with the polarization that has happened just on the political stage and how it bleeds into our world because people are glued to social media and they're manipulated by an algorithm most of the time, we don't have those conversations anymore to go, hey, we don't agree here, but it doesn't mean that every part of you is a bad person. It just means that this part we don't agree with, and there's no way that we can even get to the point of agreement if we can't even see each other as humans and as people who are worthy of being full people who have a full range of thoughts and ideas and emotions. And I think that's why you see this rise of single issue voters and people even claiming these identities. And it's one of those things where it's like, no one lives a single issue life. And I know that that's a quote from somebody. I'm trying to think of that. That's way before this time. But we're not single issue people. We are intersectional. We exist on multiple planes of existence and multiple intersections of identity. And I think we've just gotten to this point where we need to reject one side, because then it means that we accept this thing. And that's just not true. And if we can get to that point, I think people can talk more, they can mediate more, and we can, you know, reduce conflict.
I'm not a sociologist. I studied philosophy as an undergrad. But my reflections are that the identity crisis is much more severe than I think we're willing to see when we look in the mirror. And I think part of that is due to the rise in individualism, and people struggling to find their so-called tribe. And so the tribe gets formed around the single issues, and, you know, people surround themselves with people that tolerate them and tolerate their views, and don't speak up, actually, if they dissent on some of the wider issues, the peripheral issues. And that creates a dissonance, be that cognitive or actual, in the way that people are showing up, that obviously distills authenticity. But I think there's a bigger challenge of people struggling to figure out who they are and how to pass through this world safely. If all that is being modeled is this severely partisan, you're either with us or you're not with us, you're either for us or you're against us, when actually what's coming from the top is we don't really know what we stand for. It's kind of like alphabet soup, if I'm completely honest. And we have this problem with the political system in the UK. And this comes back full circle to leadership, because ultimately, how can you get behind something unless you know what that thing is stands for across the whole spectrum, not just a single issue? But I think, and it comes back to accountability, unless the secure individuals challenge both the authenticity and the accountability of what is coming from the top, who's responsible for the cohesion of society at large, we'll continue to have this fragmentation. And it is incredibly damaging, especially when that fragmentation is exacerbated by some of those social media voices that you refer to. And what that ends up distilling is people who are not able to articulate what they believe, people who do not have a solid foundation on which to have a secure identity. And therefore, you know, it does definitely affect democracy. But I think for me, I'm a Christian, so that's not something that I struggle with per se, because I know who I am and I know what I've been made to do, and I have a very clear kind of moral and ethical framework. But I think for a lot of people who don't have that or have a different worldview, it can be hard to pass through life in a society that is either not as accepting, or perhaps they're disconnected from people who share their views, or perhaps their views themselves are deemed to be unconscionable by the people who are around them. And I think that globalization has definitely had a real impact on the role of identity in society and people's ability to associate with it.
No, I absolutely agree. I think that identity is so core to and what you identify with. And a big thing I think happens is that people don't give themselves grace for changing and evolving and learning a new worldview and being like, hey, the thing that I thought before maybe isn't the thing that I feel right now, that it is okay to change my mind. I feel like colloquially we call people like that flip-floppers, or that they're not somebody who is extremely dependable because they've changed their mind. But that is what you said, a growth mindset. That is very core to it. I'm a person who, for lack of a better term, pride myself in getting new ideas, being able to assimilate them, and then act on them quickly. And yes, I have like a very core kind of foundation. Like, you notice that you come back to the same themes, like who you are. But I often also say, and I'm probably sure I say it on almost every episode, I see everything as a different point on a circular spectrum. I do not think that it's very clear when something is right or wrong, because what's right for you in your situation and in your life is not always going to be what brings me liberation. And I need to be able to understand that. I think my very delineating point of what I just do not accept is harm to children. And I think almost everything outside of that is within a gray and colorful spectrum. And I know that's not a super like popular opinion. I, for example, am a registered independent. I always have been. And it's because I do not believe in the dichotomy of almost anything. You cannot, like, even just the language we use, far right, far left, this or that. That means that there has to be a winner and a loser. And if we do that, especially in a plutocratical society where we all know that the people who are actually at top are the people who have a whole lot of resources, and it benefits them to make sure that the people at the bottom, because a pyramid, that's why I think of things as a circle, because you have to have a loser from a pyramid structure. I feel like when people start to think about that, then it changes your life. And that's why here I talk so much about asset-based wealth. I talk about sovereignty, knowing where your food comes from. Because as somebody like me who made close to $500,000 last year, it gave me that ability to be more authentic because I wasn't worried about where I'm going to live. That's why I bought this mortgage-free. But you see that everything comes down to community, because one of us can't be free if all of us aren't free. Because when you erode certain rights, and you allow this kind of overreach, it always comes back to you. That's just what history teaches, and that's just within the last 100 years. But if you even go back to 4,000 years. So I think that that is such a poignant point and like clarification and something I really want my audience, my thinkers, my founders, my anybody like to really think about. And yeah, I got really passionate about it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you said. I mean, I'm taken back to reading years ago, The Road Back to You by Suzanne Cron, I think, about the Enneagram. And I remember that the thing that struck me the most about it was these kind of 9 different personality types. And I was like, oh, so what's growth for me to be a healthy 1? Is not the same as my friend who's a 4 or my friend who's a 7. Like, actually to encourage them into the fullness of themselves, who they were made to be in its wholeness, does not look like my personal development plan. And I think encouraging people to know themselves and to work on themselves without looking sideways, without looking upwards, but just, you know, it's kind of that stay in your lane. Thing that's enabled you to be so successful, right? You're really clear about what your purpose is. You're really clear about what you're going after, and you're pursuing that wholeheartedly with a growth mindset. And therefore, people who follow your formula, if they're not on that journey, may not see those results. But if they follow the personalized plan that applies to them, unlearn the things that are holding them back, who take the risks that they need to push into in order to move forwards, they will then see that progress and development and growth. And it might be financial, it might be emotional, it might be something else entirely. But I think that whole idea, and it's more of a kind of coaching element, I suppose, we're in rather than conflict. But I'll say one more thing on that, which is the thing that prevents us from doing that, stepping into that, is our unwillingness to overcome the conflict in ourselves. Because we always think that conflict is somewhere out there and with somebody else. But actually, there is a war going on between us and our inner child to stay safe and to not press into progress for us. And I think I have been so helped by seeing the areas in myself where that has been true. But it's been a huge privilege to be able to help other people see what inner conflicts and inner turmoil are preventing them from stepping into that growth mindset.
Yeah, I think that that is such a really important thing for people to contemplate. Like, what is going on with you and how can you get out of your own way? So like you say, like, hey, I'm like super clear. I wasn't always clear. Like, I have a lot of growing to do. And you realize that there is never an arrival point. Once you realize that life is genuinely a journey and there is always something to learn, and it doesn't need to be accomplished as we like to quantify things, but what is it that you learn about yourself? I genuinely just feel like that's our purpose on the planet, to get to a point of true authenticity where you feel comfortable in your skin and communicating what it is that you need and what it is that you want without shame. I often say shame or embarrassment are low vibrational frequencies. It does no one any good. You do not grow from there. Move on from it. Because those who mind don't matter, as I tell my 5-year-old daughter, and those who matter don't mind. And it's truly, a lot of times when you're reading like these books, I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old, and it's like, these are so foundational. And what I see is my children who are just so free to be them. They don't care what their hair looks like. If there's stains on their clothes, they're just playing and enjoying being alive and just enjoying existing. And that gets beat out of us to be a part of society. Like, we get shamed. And I won't go down the whole Freud, your id, your ego, and your super ego. Like, it gets imposed on you because you're then told, if you don't do this, then you don't get your basic needs met. And as humans, we need connection. We need to feel understood, to truly feel like we have a place. And that can, like you said, lead you down not the best paths when you're only coalescing a community around this one identity factor, and you're not allowed to be your whole self. And that's where I just think it always comes back to you. Like you said, it comes back to taking stock with yourself. Even if that's daily, if that's weekly, if that's monthly, however you want to check in, it is very important to check in with yourself, just like it's important to check in with your business, with your customers, with your coworkers. Like, it's important to make sure that you are relating properly, but most importantly, that you're relating properly to yourself. And one point I'll always bring out on that is that if everyone is the problem, and everyone you associate with is the one that's wrong, usually 99.9% of the time, that means it's you.
I mean, I don't really have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's true.
It's true.
It is. And what I'm interested in from your perspective, so you said that you're a founder. What is your business? Let's talk about it.
So I run the Wayfinders Group. And okay. The Wayfinders Group basically helps leaders and organizations navigate change and conflict and crisis. And we're a values-driven problem-solving company with a heart for this relational transformation. And it's worth saying, when I started the business, the kind of scarlet thread, or the tool, the methodology behind the change management was the mediation toolbox. But the more mediation I did, the more I found that that felt very transactional, right? You come with a problem and, like, we've got to get to the root of the problem and then figure out how everybody wants to move forward. But that didn't really deal with rebuilding trust or dealing with the relationships. And so I started exploring restorative justice. And that, to me, has opened a massive can of worms, where I've been delivering international programs on restorative justice. We've recently released a white paper embedding restorative principles in the government, and dreaming about a world in where that happens for all the publicly funded institutions in the UK, and designing a blueprint for change. Because actually, unless we can work out how to rebuild relationships, we can restructure organizations as much as we want to, but the underlying problems are still going to be there. So at the heart of the Wayfinders Group is a heart for people, and a heart for people being transformed, whether they want to or not. As a kind of byproduct of, you know, helping them through difficult situations and enabling people to be the best versions of themselves.
Yeah. Could you, for the audience, for me, just for any, again, with definitions, can you explain a little bit more about what you mean and the Wayfinders Group means when you say restorative justice?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what I'm talking about is where somebody has experienced something that has hurt them or harmed them in some way. And that process of enabling somebody to feel like what they've experienced has been acknowledged, that they have received an apology for it, that somebody has taken responsibility for it. And then that process of restorative justice is that making amends. We so often presume what the solution is when somebody's been harmed. So, for example, if you slip on the floor in a hospital, they will pay you money, depending on a scale for how damaged your ankle is. And that's it. That's what justice looks like. But what if you just wanted an apology from the cleaner? Or what if what you really wanted was to make sure that this didn't happen to anybody else? You couldn't get justice in the traditional sense. So unless the organization or the institution or the leaders of that institution are willing to engage in a process with you, a lot of survivors cannot achieve justice. And so we're on a mission at the Wayfinders Group to embed these restorative approaches, not just in government institutions, but in employers, in schools, in hospitals, in local authorities, you know, in all kinds of forums, because for all the reasons that we've mentioned, from polarization onwards, relationships really are the bedrock of society. And so we've got to figure out a way to do better. And unfortunately, as leaders, it starts with us.
No, absolutely. Society literally doesn't exist without relationships. It's no longer society. That is why this is seed and society. You put in the ideas, you get out that connectivity. What would you say? So first, from that perspective of restorative justice, it also sounded like great, again, relationship advice in general, like acknowledging people, asking what would make them feel better, not assuming, and then going from that. How do you tend to see those frameworks actually work? What I'm getting to is, oftentimes, is it like, hey, this is what would make me feel like justice happened, and then the response from the perpetrator, for lack of a better term, is usually what?
The restorative justice process is very similar to the mediation process, except that the restorative process gives an opportunity for the offender to explain why they have done what they have done. Which is very unusual, because the courts don't ask that, and so a survivor might never find out. But the other unique thing about the restorative process is that it gives the survivor the opportunity to ask the offender how they would feel about making amends and stating their terms. So if, for example, shoplifting is on the agenda in England at the moment. There's people looting supermarkets left, right, and center. Let's say you own a small shop and, somebody has stolen violently from you. You're not going to get the goods back because they've all been consumed. But if the shop owner is the survivor in that situation, what they might ask for is that person to come and work with them, right? To see the value of what it is that's being offered, to, you know, be a part of the community and to apologize to the other people in the community that they've affected. You know, you can make what might seem to an outsider outlandish requests or strange requests, or maybe really seemingly small requests, but that would be deemed justice in a survivor's mind. I think that with all of our research, what we've seen is that survivors want to ensure that whatever has happened to them doesn't happen to somebody else, which is almost selfless, but it kind of goes to the core of humanity, right? When there's something that has been so grossly wrong, and you can't put that person back in the position that they would have been in if it hadn't happened, the next best thing is that it couldn't happen to somebody else. And so prison isn't necessarily justice to a lot of people, and part of that is its focus on punitive rather than rehabilitation. But I think it depends on the crime, it depends on the person, and it depends on whether a restorative process is available. But I think, to your point, if you bring this into a workplace, for example, where, somebody's committed misconduct or stolen something out of the fridge from somebody else, the same principles apply, because the issue is that trust is broken down, and yet they need to coexist in the same environment. And so the process is exactly the same, unless you want to continue to sweep things under the rug and pretend that things haven't gone wrong, which is where the whole toxic culture thing permeates, because people are no longer starting with step one, acknowledge what has happened. If we can't get consensus on what has happened, we absolutely cannot move any closer towards justice.
This is so beautiful. That is just such a beautiful concept of how to genuinely move forward. I think it's really important how you pointed out, like, not just going straight to punitive measures, not just deciding that it's going to be a monetary benefit or a punishment benefit. And especially when we have a society where, you know, like America locks up 40% of the world's prisoners while being 4% of the world's population. And it's not rehabilitative, as you said. It's not a system that is meant to help people reintegrate and come back in. And I won't go down the new Jim Crow with Michelle Alexander and all of those things. But recidivism is something that's like near and dear to my heart. And I talk about that often because, you know, being from like Philly, and like you said, someone steals from a store or something, I instantly think, were they hungry? Right? But that's not how our justice system necessarily sees it. But then where does the injustice come in? So that is extremely important work. And like you said, it really permeates every aspect of society. What I will ask now, is there anything else that you want the audience to know? Like, what is the takeaway? What do you want people to know when they hear Leah Brown and the Wayfinders group?
Thanks for asking. We're about to go into a season of campaigning, I think. I am launching a coalition for institutional accountability, where me and a bunch of other UK leaders will be asking for legislative amendments to embed some of these restorative approaches in new legislation that's coming up on the parliamentary docket. And hopefully we'll be able to do a crowdfund to bring out some of those survivor voices and some of those survivor stories. Because we think that in an era of storytelling being so powerful, there are so many people who have been suppressed by the system. And so we want to give an opportunity for people to see themselves in other people's stories and to find that courage and candor to be able to share their experiences with leaders who don't have that lived experience. And so all of this feels very alien to them. And so I think to bridge that gap, because that's a lot of what we do. But I think also do follow us on social media and let us know if you're interested in being involved or sharing some of our work or getting the word out there. We would always be grateful for that.
That is awesome. And all of these links will also be down in the show notes. I think what you're doing is such powerful work. It's such needed work. It's such timely work. And it's really a genuine way to make this world better and to make this world last. Because like you said, society is relationships. It is community. And it doesn't help if half the population hates the other half and people can't find a middle ground and find a way to still see the humanity in each other. I thank you so much for coming on this podcast. This is my other guests probably won't like it. This is probably my favorite conversation just because it very much is needed, and it touches genuinely. And I implore my audience to go back and listen to this episode again, because it touches just the heart of anything you do, whether it's your relationship with your children, your relationship with your homestead, your relationship with your business, your customers, your partner, your relationship with your community. These are the fundamental bedrocks of truly moving forward as humans. So I am so grateful that you came on this show, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been an awesome conversation.